when somebody's going to sell an office building, it usually doesn't go for pennies on the dollar. It's still outfitted, and it is, it costs 100 plus square foot at some point, no matter when it was built, usually above that. And so to demolish all that and start over is usually a little bit difficult. And sometimes we have challenges with the floors, but versus just starting with a manufacturing warehouse or an empty warehouse or a grocery store where it's gutted and it's an industrial and all it is just a metal shell. Well, that's inexpensive to buy in the first place. And then we just add our mezzanines and the units inside. Whereas like an office building or a school, if you will, or a hotel, to try to repurpose those.
Are you ready to transform your life? This is a no-nonsense show helping immigrants like you create generational wealth, even while working full-time. Get ready to take notes. Here's your host, Saket Jain.
Welcome back, Migrate to Wealth listeners. Today, I have the pleasure to introduce to you an asset class that we haven't talked about on this show. Doesn't mean it's a bad asset class. I just didn't get the right person to bring to the show. Now we have Scott Myers. How are you, Scott?
I am doing it fantastic, Saket. Good to see you.
Good to see you too, buddy. I love the red hat there. Cloverleaf up there?
It is. It's a brand. Black Clover is the name of the brand. This is Live Lucky, and it's like the only brand of hat that fits my head, and I don't like what's underneath it anymore, so this is what I'm wearing these days.
Well, I don't think it's going to be, it can be worse than this, than what I have, so it's all right. Awesome, Scott. Well, Scott, we're glad to have you on, buddy. Scott,
thanks. Good to be here.
I talked about the asset class a little bit. I think we're going to be not keeping the suspense for too long. The asset class we're going to talk about today is going to be the asset class that's the only asset class you stay in, which is storage, self-storage units. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk more detail about that. Before we talk about that, I would love to hear from you the perspective of when you heard the term migrate to wealth, what did that mean to you?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I think, if you look, migrating to wealth, it means that you're coming from somewhere else. And I think maybe it's an income or active income. True, when people get to the place where they have wealth, it means that not necessarily that they've arrived, but wealth really kind of, I think, has a little different connotation to it. It means that probably produces a little more freedom. And once you have wealth or are wealthy, you're maybe able to call a few more shots and you're not always in the active income mode, I suppose would probably be the best way I would talk about or describe migration to wealth.
I love that. Scott, so help us understand when you started out thinking about wealth to where you are, give us the two, if that perspective has changed for you, would love to hear that. And then paint us a picture of how you connect the two dots.
You know, in the beginning, I started out as an active investor, like, well, some people on this podcast are maybe listening by following the Carlton Sheets method, if you remember his old...
I don't know, where are those cassettes?
Oh my gosh, VHS and cassettes. Yeah. We're going back a little ways, so this is back in 19... Well, it had been 1992, it was 1993, it was when I bought my first residential, single-family residential rental, and so I followed that program. And, of course, if you follow his program, you get to the place where I think it was 15 properties you own free and clear. So you have 30, you sell 15 off, and you own 15 free and clear, and then that's wealth. And so that's the migration at the time. Well, I found that we were doing this following his system and rehabbing, refinancing, doing the Burr method before it was called and cool to use the Burr method term, and refinancing these properties after rehabbing them and renting them out. And then we got to the place where we did, after one, we doubled down and refinanced and then did two more. And then we continued to do more and more. And by this time, I had my fiance, who then became my wife, finally, after about 16 houses or so, said, either I quit or you fire me, one of the two, because I've had enough of this. And so, at that point, we realized that, and it's tough if you slug it out on that side of the business, to the place where you get them all paid off, or when you get to, the critical mass where you can hire a property management company or a property manager, it is. It's all you. You know, you're doing this along with a spouse or maybe a business partner here and there and some contractors. And so we just felt that I needed to amp it up very quickly. And so we got into multifamily. And so we started buying just smaller to medium size, 50, 60, 80, 100 unit complexes. And all they did was just buy us more tenants and toilets and trash and more headaches that went along with it. And even though we had management companies and managers, at the end of the day, we're still in the habitation or real estate business and dealing with people. And so, at this point, and realizing that this wasn't the freedom that I had been told by Carlton Sheets, and we didn't have the cash flow that we had anticipated. And it wasn't because we weren't bad operators. It was just the business model is a tough one.
Right.
And so at that point, then we decided, I'm unemployable at this point, like you, once you get out, as you know,
I'm done, Matt. For a while. I don't think people may be able to hire me. They won't be able to keep me anymore.
I would not be a good employee. I never was one. Yeah. You know, those of us that feel the calling to go do something on our own. Yeah. You know, when I would if I had to support my family, that'd be fine. But I realized that we needed to do something different in real estate, and so that's when we began to look into self-storage, because that was, that was the challenge. Was, the tenants, the toilets, and the trash, and people destroying the property and not paying, and the courts are not favorable to, the big, bad, rich landlord in those instances. But when I looked into self-storage, there are no tenants, there are no toilets, there are no trash. And when somebody doesn't pay, you lock them out, and then you sell their stuff to recoup your money, your lost rent and late fees. And I thought, well, now that's a business model in real estate that I can get behind. And so the more I looked into the model, and I saw how well the industry has done as a whole historically, and how it does not only does good during the good times, inflationary periods when people are buying more stuff, but also as the economy is retracting, people are downsizing and businesses are downsizing, self-storage actually does better. And so it's very inflation-proof and recession-proof. And I said, well, that's for me. And so, all those ingredients combined, I don't want to say force us, but we just saw the light and said that we're moving away from houses and apartments. And we sold everything. We had about 80 houses and 400 apartment units and sold all those and got into self-storage and then just began acquiring and then developing and then converting and buying industrial warehouses and grocery stores and vacant buildings and turning them into self-storage. And now we're at the place where we're approaching 5 million square feet of self-storage and 28,000 units nationwide. All by way of syndication and by way of our fund and raising capital with folks that have come alongside of us. And and then also we created an education company along the way to teach people how to do the exact same thing that we're doing. And that has allowed us to create a number of different partnerships and even grow our community to kind of feed off of one another.
Yeah, and I love that. Love that, Scott, what you just told us. There's so much in there, right? Starting from one single family, now owning over 5 million square feet of space, which is great. Mm-hmm. When you were starting out, I'm going to go back to that point one more time. Why did you start listening to Carlin Sheets? Mm-hmm. Everyone has a story. Like, what was going at that point in your life that actually encouraged you or forced you, don't know what was going on? Mm-hmm. Give us a little bit more insight into that.
Sure. It started with basically my first job when I actually had a little more money left over at the end of, all the expenses. Yeah. I finally, realized that, dad said you need to start investing. And so I began looking into investing in stocks, bonds, mutual funds. And, Socket, every book that I read, just about every book that I read in the back, somewhere, at the end of the book said, oh, and by the way, you can also invest in real estate for retirement.
Right.
And the more I began to research and that, which led me to not only Carlton Sheets, but also Robert Kiyosaki and others. And I found that, the folks that have created the most wealth in the world created it in real estate, not in stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. I mean, the S&P 500 on average returns 7%, and those are the folks that are
doing before taxes.
Before taxes.
Yeah.
And when you look at real estate, the returns, even as a passive investors, are in the high teens to 20s. And then the active investors obviously are doing better than that. And so then that's when I began my journey to read everything I could get my hands on how to invest in real estate, really as a hedge to retirement, just to bolster my retirement instead of relying on, the big casino up in Wall Street. I have a little more control over it. And so that's when we began buying the houses, and then it just it just kind of took on a life of its own. I'd always been kind of a junker anyways. I used to buy bikes when I was a kid or pull them out of the trash and fix them and sell them to my friends, and then I did it with cars, and then we just started doing it with real estate. And so I've always liked to find value add real estate that we can value add anything that we can turn around and clean up, fix, repair, change the processes of the business model. And to be able to, regentrify, real estate, it was just a natural fit. And so once we started doing more and more, then it just, then I realized that, okay, I don't think I want to work for anybody else any longer. And when I can, I see exactly what I can do on my own, and I can kind of predict the path to profitability and not let my future resolve in the hands of somebody else.
And Scott, how long did it take you to quit your job?
Yeah, about 5 years. And we got to that place. Probably a little early, too. I probably should have had a few more houses in our belt. It was a little tight in the beginning, but at the end of the day, it was still the right move.
That's amazing, man. That's amazing. So, Scott, I know in your journey, you've seen at least 2 to 3 cycles, business cycles, economic cycles. Tell us, as you reflect back on that, of course, back in the 90s, you didn't expect the dot-com crash. Then 2008, nobody expected that. I think people were predicting it. No one's expecting it that bad. Mm-hmm. And that the current cycle we're in right now. So how did you persevere these? Because a lot of folks have sold their portfolio, right? Because it's still an emotional game. It's still silver, sure. Human beings are involved. The fear and the greed, mm-hmm. it's there. Mm-hmm. Yes. Nobody can deny that. So how did you mm-hmm. persevere? Can you help us understand that?
Yeah, of course. So back in 99, in 2000 with the dot-com crash, we were still in single-family houses and apartments. And you know, at that time, you know, prior to that, we were still buying the portfolio to grow it. We weren't selling anything. Hindsight, we probably should have, you know, for every third property, you know, every three properties we buy, we probably should have sold that third one to keep some cash in play. But we would just continue to grow and refinance. And then, yeah, after the dot-com crash, then that's when the Community Reinvestment Act was instituted by the administration at that time to bolster the economy again. And so basically, yeah. those were the programs, the loans, in which anybody who could basically fog a mirror could buy a house. And so now all of our tenants were leaving in droves because they could buy a house. They could own a home for the first time in their lives. And who could blame them? So now these houses that we rehabbed to be able to rent, now we had to re-rehab. And instead of spending, you know, the $5,000 to $7,000 to $8,000, you know, to get them in shape to rent, we had to go back and re-rehab them again to get top of the market appraisal to sell, because that's the way the market had shifted. Mm-hmm. So that took every bit of cash, and it almost took us under. It took us to the brink of bankruptcy when we had to, you know, re-rehab all these things again and then try to sell them because our vacancies were high because everybody was leaving. You know, all our good tenants were leaving. And our vacancies were high because everybody was buying homes, and we just had a rental model. And so we made it through that. And then we, you know, put some safeguards and some guardrails in place to make sure that didn't happen again. And then, you know, fast forward. So now that Community Reinvestment Act and all those loans, well, we all know what happened then in 2008. Yeah. And yeah. Those loans tanked. Those very same loans tanked. And, you know, we didn't predict that that was coming, but I was in self-storage at that time. And so recessions are good for self-storage. They do very well. And so all we did at that time was we weathered the storm. But I saw that the amount of cash that we had, we were able to then gobble up, you know, some of these properties, mm-hmm. some self-storage facilities, not because the storage facilities were doing bad, but the investors, they were in other asset classes. And, you know, that was a real estate bubble. And so everything mm-hmm. and everybody, you know, not everybody, but many people, you know, tanked, and they were losing everything. So we were able to pick up some self-storage facilities. Yeah, again, no fault of the facilities, but just because the owners, you know, had issues with their other asset yeah. classes or just in general. And so I saw at that time, Sock, and I said, I'm not going to allow this to happen again the next cycle. We're going to have more and better lending relationships. We're going to have mm-hmm. deeper pockets, and we're going to have a treasure chest of cash, because when this happens again, you know, well, people can't refinance or they're losing their properties, you know, and they got to give their keys back to the bank. Well, we want to be there to catch those keys. We right. want to be able to make those Definitely. Cash offers. And I watched the REITs and the larger players, you know, they cleaned house, they mopped up because they had cash and they could act quickly. So yeah, fast forward again, you know, the pandemic was called another economic cycle. It was, you know, it modeled a recession, albeit a short amount of time. Businesses were shut down and individuals lost their jobs, and that created a demand for storage, and the banks, you know, shut down for a little while. And so that created another more demand for storage. And so we were able to, you know, take advantage at that time. But now heading into this high interest rate environment, and where, again, some of these folks that didn't create value in their facilities have to refinance. And instead of a 90% or 80% LTV loan at 4% interest rate, now the banks are at 65% LTV right. and an 8% interest rate. And some of these folks aren't making it, and we're buying again. I mean, there's, you know, you always wish you had more cash, but, you know, the pipeline of deals that we have coming across our table right now is pretty much matching the cash that we have and we're able to raise.
Oh, so perfect.
We're in pretty decent shape now. Yeah.
That is amazing. So Scott, a few things there. One thing is, you mentioned that mm-hmm. self-storage units are recession proof. Or maybe you didn't use that word, but I heard that.
Recession resistant. How's that?
I like that. I was going to go with that word, but I went recession proof. Recession yep. resistant. So help me understand why during the recession, the demand for storage units goes up, because it seemed like counterintuitive, right? When somebody can't afford to pay for a mortgage or something else, and they don't have a job, mm-hmm. why would they have a storage unit? Because the first thing to get rid of is the junk they have. That would be, the intuition will tell me.
We actually, it's a little bit counterintuitive, but we are in the trauma and transition business. And when people have trauma in their lives and they're in transition, that is when there's a need for storage. It's demand-based. It's not necessarily want-based. It is driven by, if somebody loses a job, their job, if they're living on their own, you know, maybe they can't afford their apartment, or they have to, you know, tighten the budget a little bit until they get a job again. Or if they've got a job that doesn't pay as much, they may move back home. Well, in the meantime, they're going to put their stuff in storage. Or if
I see that. That makes sense.
You know, comes back home and they can't afford where they're living or renting, they consolidate, or people move in with each other into an apartment or into the house at the same time. There's just stuff that they can't take with them, you know, so they'll put it in storage until things and time turns back around again, until they can begin to take those things out of storage. And that's the same for businesses. Many businesses that struggle during a recession, they may put some of their inventory, or maybe they lost their lease, or they sold their building and now they're subleasing, right, or they're leasing a smaller portion of their business. So inventory and machinery, equipment, furniture goes into storage until things turn back around again. You know, they just don't sell it all in many cases. And so that all goes into storage. And so actually we do better as an industry. Occupancy increases and it remains at a higher level during a recession versus when times are good.
Love that. And Scott, for those who are not, who have not been initiated into self-storage until this conversation, help us understand. You said there's a lot of conversion that you did, grocery store from empty warehouse. And I'm going to tie it to one of the biggest conversation right now, empty office buildings.
They are
not necessarily out in the remote. They're some of those buildings are right in the smack middle of downtown.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So help me understand that when you look at conversion, what is driving the conversion of an empty space into storage? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we have, our model is a 3-prong approach. The quickest way to get into a self-storage, into the industry or business or to buy another one is to buy another one, go buy an existing self-storage facility. And so that's fantastic. And to the extent that we can find those value add facilities, that's our preferred method. Then what is most traditional is then the building. You buy a piece of dirt or you have a piece of land and you build a facility from the ground up.
Yeah.
But as you know, that takes a lot of time. It takes a long time from planning and zoning to get permitted and to get everything in place to before you even turn a shovel. And then you're, about a year until you get a facility built. And then after a certificate of occupancy, you've got a year and a half or so until you begin to break even in cash flow. That's a challenge in and of itself. But in between there is a conversion opportunity whereby we can buy a vacant industrial building or an old grocery store, a hardware store, a warehouse that is either older or, a Walmart has moved across to a town to a nicer, better location in a bigger store, or, any number of businesses that go out just as a matter of the community changing or just because they went out of business. Amazon's put a lot of retail and therefore retail spaces out of a business as well. Amazon didn't do it. It's just you get it, the migration,
right,
of people buying online. And so for us, then those are, we search for and typically can find then those prime locations. They're infill locations. They're already in an area which is either zoned for storage or it's easy to then get a permit, for a permitted use for storage. Mm-hmm. It's already in a fantastic location with a high traffic count located where people live. And now we've got a shell, and hopefully it's a solid shell. And we've just, cut off a whole lot of time that it takes to get zoning and to build the building. Now we just go in and in 6 to 8 months, then we outfit it. We put in the walls and doors, we change the exterior to the extent that it has to, which is usually just paint and some awnings and some doors.
Right.
And so just much quicker to market. And as you and I both know, speed is more key than just the, the budget itself. Right. I mean, yes, we have with the numbers, but if we get these vacant buildings for pennies on the dollar and then we get it into market at 8 months, that beats waiting 2 years for anything because time is money. So that is our preferred model that we're working right now.
Amazing. So when we talk about conversion, you're not talking about converting office buildings. You're talking about warehouses.
Yeah. You mentioned office buildings, and I failed to answer that. And so office buildings, we've only done one up to this point, and mainly because when somebody's going to sell an office building, it usually doesn't go for pennies on the dollar. It's still outfitted, and it costs 100 plus square foot at some point, no matter when it was built, usually above that. And so to demolish all that and start over is usually a little bit difficult. And sometimes we have challenges with the floors, but versus just starting with a manufacturing warehouse or an empty warehouse or a grocery store where it's gutted. And it's an industrial and all it is just a metal shell. Well, that's inexpensive to buy in the first place. And then we just add our mezzanines and the units inside. Whereas, an office building or a school, if you will, or a hotel, to try to repurpose those with all the concrete walls and the partitions and everything in place, it's really difficult to get the unit mix that works for us without having extensive demolition costs on top of that. They usually just don't work.
Yeah, that makes sense. And Scott, for somebody who's looking at the storage units as one of their next asset class, either as an active or as a passive, can you give a very, very broad stroke perspective on what is involved in running a data? What parameters are you looking at? Very broad stroke. Yeah.
Well, so, they say if all you have is a hammer, then everything looks like a nail and I'm only in self-storage. And so you could say I'm biased. However, I was not biased. When I got into self-storage, I was in houses, I was in apartments, I was in office buildings. We were doing warehouses. We had parking lots. I'd looked at mobile home parks. We'd looked at assisted living. Yeah. And I continue to come back to self-storage because it outperforms. I mean, you look anywhere online or elsewhere in any, commercial real estate publication, self-storage as an industry, as a sector, as an asset class, has consistently for the past 25 years outperformed all the other asset classes. So I didn't get into it, Saka, because it's sexy, because it's not. You know, they're metal boxes and concrete slabs. What's sexy, the performance, you know, you can't beat the performance of the sector. And from an operation standpoint, it's a simple, predictable business model that if you nail it and you replicate it, you know, we can rinse and repeat over and over again. And we got the operation side down. We got the numbers down. You know, we know what we're doing. So, you know, all we need to do is just add fuel to the fire by way of capital, and we know how and where to go out and find the sites and what it takes to be able to operate these. So that's, again, I'd say that I'm biased, and only because I love it, but I only got bias because of the stats and looking into the industry. I just, you know, if there's a better asset class or a better way to make money, then I'll be the first in line. But we're so big on self-storage right now, and it continues to just get better.
So, Scott, like, you know, every asset class has a cycle. It usually does.
Yep.
Like 10 years ago, multifamily was great. If you rode that wave, great, because now it's going to come back again.
Yep.
So help us understand the storage units with the cap rates being so compressed. How does that translate? I know about multifamily fairly well.
Right.
How does that translate it into the cap rates for the storage units, and where do you see the market going?
Yeah, so cap rates really lagged behind the rest of the other asset classes in self-storage, just because, once again, as we head into a time where, you know, as you said, multifamily and the other asset classes are going down in value and the compression of the cap rates, what we've seen in self-storage is it was still a very desirable asset class for all those reasons. So as we head into a recession, you know, there's a lag time in storage because there's still people chasing storage. As a matter of fact, you could argue, and there's more people that are chasing storage heading into a recession because the yield is here where it isn't right now in multifamily. It isn't. In assisted living or hotels, motels, mobile home parks, but it's there in storage. And so, you know, we've had some strong, we continue to have strong cap rates on exit. And we're also able to get, because banks know that self-storage does so well during a recession, these are the loans they want on their books as they head into a recession. So we're still getting favorable. We got lenders that are just, you know, continuing to ask, put more deals in front of us. We want to bolster our balance sheet. We're getting rates in the 5.5% to 6.5% interest rate range, where other asset classes are, you know, well above that, 7% and 8%. So we've, you know, this freight train called self-storage just continues to roll on. You know, even though we're in a recession, we're able to, you know, kind of beat those returns and get that yield where others are struggling.
That's amazing. And Scott, if you have, again, a broad stroke question, because every storage unit is going to be different. When you look at a cash on cash and a storage unit, what are we looking at on average?
Yeah, you're right. Everything's different. And some of ours start out, you know, we got kind of two camps. You've got the wealth creation where, you know, that's a development or a conversion where there's just no return for a little while, for, you know, 18 months or 2 years until, you know, we get up and rolling again. So, you know, 6% to 8%, that includes the pref that we pay out. And then after that, we're in the 10% to 12% to the teens on some of them. You know, we've got another project that we're working on right now, which is, it's one of multiple where our cash on cash is in the 40% range. These are very strong projects that we found in a part of the world that is very favorable right now, which we're excited about. But by and large, I think if you're seeing that 8% and above, it's kind of average in the beginning, because everything we have, again, turnaround or development, very low in the beginning to then getting up to that, you know, low to mid teens.
And then the exit path is the same. You sell them.
It is
keeping them.
Very, very rare that we would refinance and keep anything, just because in order to get the IRR to our investors, in order to attract the capital, you know, that we need from our investors, that they usually, you know, involves a sale versus us keeping it and then keeping some of that equity in it. So we're in that 3 to 5 year range, depending upon the project. If it's a turnaround, it may take 3 years. If it's a development or a conversion, we're in the 4 to 5 year range before we, you know, all the concessions burn off and we're stabilized, and then we can sell for the maximum.
Awesome. And I know a lot of my investors are also, maybe listeners as well, also look at the bonus depreciation as one of the key tax reductions.
Yeah.
Does that apply to storage units?
It does, and in a big way. Yeah, we do engineering studies, cost segs on each and every project. And the beauty of self-storage is that some of our projects, our cost seg engineers and the companies we use have been able to depreciate up to 80% of the facility, because of the construction is different than, you know, the other asset classes. It's all metal. We got metal movable walls. We got doors with moving mechanisms on it. So we can depreciate a whole lot more of that asset and that building than the other asset classes. And it was great when we could take Section 179 in the first year, although that's...
Hopefully it comes back again, right?
I hope it comes back again. Yeah. But nevertheless, say, you know, even if we do it over several years, the fact that we...
You're not losing the depreciation, it's just impact goes down. But I think, to be honest, a lot of folks can't use it anyways. They just don't realize.
Some folks don't. Yeah. Many of our folks, you know, we started separating our classes of shares and our funds because, you know, those folks that are investing out of a self-directed IRA, if it's lost on them, then, you know, we would not offer it to them, and we would take all the depreciation and then push it to our folks that are just using cash or investing.
That's an interesting idea. So how do you do that? How do you incentivize the IRA investors? Do you bump up their returns?
No, they still get a strong return. We try to stay 1 to 2 points above our competition, if you want to call it that. We're all of us syndicators, we're in the money business, if you will. We're trying to attract investors. And so for us, it starts with, first of all, our history. We've been at this longer than, most people out there, syndicators out there, doing this for 30 years. Mm-hmm. We've got 36% IRR is our average over the past 16 years that we've been syndicating our project. And so, we've been doing this for a little while, we got strong returns, but then, our projects have a higher return, up front. So if somebody's offering, 20% IRR on a development of a self-storage facility or multifamily or anything else, then we want to be in the 21 to 22% range and attract folks that way. Right. And our projects are strong enough that we're able to do so. So that's how we've been able to attract capital. Does that answer your question?
It does. Because I think I was thinking about it from a depreciation perspective in different classes.
Yeah.
Do you get a pushback from the IRE investors that why am I going to give up my depreciation without getting a benefit?
Well, they don't get it anyways. If it goes to these folks and they're still getting a strong return, that allows us to, they're strong projects. And if they're not interested in this project, they're not going to get that path through in another project where they're only getting a 20% IRR. A 22% IRR to us is better than 20 over there. And
definitely, man.
It's not an issue. It doesn't matter.
Any 1% of the IRR helps, especially when you're talking about 2 percentage points. That's even better. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Scott, this has been great, man. So I'm going to switch the gears to a different topic now in the interest of time. Scott, as you've had an exciting journey, and you're going to continue to have an exciting journey. And I wish you all the success in that. But there's a 20-year-old Scott Myers somewhere listening to this podcast who's thinking about, his first job. And maybe one of your kids is in that stage. I don't know where your kids are. If you have kids, I have no idea.
Yep, I do.
What kind of values would you impart to them? Like, what's going to be one that you were to pick only one? What would that be?
It's interesting, Saket, that the people that invest with us, and this is, it's nothing that you can find anybody until you begin to work with them or if you partner with them and doing business with them, and that's the integrity piece. As we found, and any of the heads of the family offices, anybody else, will just say, "Listen, it's all about the jockey, and the thing that we need to see and understand is the integrity piece." And you won't know that until you begin investing with someone. And so, at the end of the day, nobody out there on your podcast knows me from Adam, but that is why we've been able to do exactly what we've been able to do is because we do what we say we do, and we've done it for the past 30 years, and that's why our folks continue to invest with us. We don't know how to do it any other way. That's my personal journey, and part of that is my faith journey as well. And I answer to somebody else. I have an audience of one. And from that standpoint, that's the way we run our business. And come to find out, people are attracted to that. So that has been the secret. And if I could add another piece to that is, when we talk to our kids, you model that for your kids. You can't tell them to have integrity. You model that for your kids. But the piece that we have told them and just to continue to have conversations is just self-awareness. It's the best gift you can give yourself. And that's the best gift you can give your kids is for them to be self-aware. They're going to hear information all over the place and from everyone, from culture to, their friends, to whoever. And at the end of the day, just your gut instinct and just knowing who you are, what is the right decisions and the best decisions for you usually still wins out. It doesn't mean that you don't need to have a multitude of counselors, advisors, and mentors along the way. But really, those decisions, seem some ones that I've regretted the most are the ones that I kind of bent towards somebody else's, leaning and thinking that I needed to either please them or that sounded like good advice. Only to find out that I should have listened to the voice in my head that said I should have gone this direction because that's the way I ended up going anyways, and that was the right way to go. So those are the two pieces. You just need to operate from a place of integrity, period. And just self-aware, just knowing who you are, what your limitations are, and any decision is made from that.
I would love to go deeper into the second aspect of that.
Right? Yeah.
So, and I don't think I have an answer yet because I think I'm still searching for that answer. Maybe you have an answer. How do you know your voice from all the noise that the external environment has fed you to? How do you know the difference? Have you figured that out?
Yeah, well, Saki, you and I have been around a little while, and it's never perfect. There's always that balance. And again, I still seek advice, and I still have mentors and folks that I run things past all the time, and I still get it wrong, whether it's listening to my voice or what I feel is the right direction every once in a while. But it's not lost on the learning experience from that. Even now, we're on another journey within our business. And I'm excited because I'm learning so much, and it's been a while, in this fairly static business, to learn how to do business in different parts of the world. And I'm excited again. And, as much as I thought I knew a whole lot about a whole lot of things, I'm recognizing that I still got a little bit to learn here and there.
That's good.
But I learned from that, and I'll only make, I wouldn't even say a mistake, but I'll I'll learn from something once and I won't do it again. You know, now the path thinking will be different this time. You know, I take all that in, and, you know, experience is the best, you know, education you can get. And it doesn't mean that, you know, we have an education company, people pay us to learn about it. And boy, that circumvents and short circuits, you know, they pay for speed and shorten the learning curve. I do that as well. I'm a part of masterminds and I pay for mentors and consultants. But all of that is just wrapped around, you know, just, you know, having a sense for what is the right thing to do here in the situation, where it's right, what's the right decision for me and my business. And usually those calls that you make from the gut that you draw on from experience are the ones that are the right ones.
Love that. Scott, thank you again for appreciate that. Now, you said twice in this episode, I'm going to come back to that, and then I'm going to ask the question is, you're doing something interesting part of the world. And this came up again, that you're thinking about doing this outside of the U.S. That's where I heard, at least. I mean, are you able to share what you're thinking of doing?
Yes. Yeah, so we've, you know, this past year, we've been, we raise capital that is the fuel for our growth. And we've been reaching out to a number of family offices here in the U.S. and individuals that have been part of our ecosystem that have been passively investing with us for years. But, you know, heading into this economic cycle, we knew that there was going to be more opportunities for us to be able to take down some projects as there's trouble in the economy, like last time. And it never hurts to have more connections for that. And so I had somebody actually approach us to go over to the Middle East. And there's a number of folks over there that love U.S. real estate. And so some of the sovereign wealth funds and some of the family offices and hedge funds in other parts of the world are interested in U.S. real estate because of the predictability, our legal structure and the SEC that really keeps an eye on us. It doesn't necessarily protect them as investors, but it protects the syndicators, you know, from doing bad things for the most part because of the penalties. And so we've been able to have a number of conversations with folks over there that they're excited about self-storage. And so we've been raising capital and making some contacts with the folks over there that are going to be able to fuel our growth over here. So awesome. It's been exciting to learn about different models of financial models and just having those discussions to be able to explain it all over again in a way that is coming to a different audience, which has been fun.
That's awesome. And congratulations again. I think it's not an easy feat, especially to start attracting sovereign wealth.
Yeah, it's not, but it's been fun. And again, a learning experience, and there's nothing to lose, so nothing to be nervous about. It's just, and we found that the audience is very open and receptive.
I have a feeling you're just using a different language, but still the same skill set. You're still saying the same exact thing. You just have to use a different language now.
That's awesome. It.
Scott, this is great, man. So next question, buddy. It's going to be a little bit more philosophical question. Where do you feel, as you reflect back on your journey, your interactions, especially now across cultural boundaries, when I think across cross national boundaries, where do you see there's a gap in humanity right now? Where should we as humans migrate?
You know, it's I think the two go hand in hand, but it's trust and transparency. People don't trust, and so they're not as willing to be as transparent. And as I look at other parts of the world now, you know, there's even more so a lack of trust in some other areas and markets that we go into. And you know, you go back to the days of JP Morgan when he started his bank in the 1800s, and deals were done on a handshake on his boat out in New York Harbor. And now, you know, every document that we have, especially when it pertains to those types of deals with the SEC, it's 70 pages. And that's all as a result of case law because of, you know, bad actors throughout the years. So people aren't necessarily trusting. They're not as transparent. And it's just unfortunate that we've moved so far away from that even the folks that you think that you can trust, even down to partners, that money will get in the way, or, you know, there's many folks out there that feel as if they have to win, that there's less, I would say also, there's less striving for both sides to create a win-win scenario. There seems to be more of a, we're moving back to or moving towards a place where there has to be a winner and a loser in negotiations and business deals, instead of truly getting, you know, walking away from a negotiating table or getting the business where everybody feels like they gave a little towards it, instead of, you know, winning and getting more from the other side and feeling as if they won. So that's, you know, it's just a divisive nature out there, not only in the U.S. from a political standpoint to anything, but I think people just aren't as willing to work with their fellow man. They just look at it more in terms of an adversarial position versus, let's just all go together and move fast and forward together.
And I love what you said, trust and transparency, right? Because I think it really starts at the top, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And you're not trusting the system. You're not trusting people inside the system, period.
100%. You're right.
And the agendas at the top are not aligned with the agendas at the bottom. When I say bottom, people like us.
Yeah.
I'm counting myself in there. That's it's hard to break out of that because it needs a certain amount of courage to break out of that and question, especially what other people are going to consider you crazy for, may consider you crazy for. Mm-hmm. And that takes a very different kind of person, I believe.
Yeah.
But it's needed. It's definitely needed. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Scott,
it is.
Sorry, anything that you believe in the last 30, 40 minutes that we should have covered, and you wanted to say that I didn't ask the question or you didn't get a chance to speak on.
I don't know, Saket. A big piece of what we do, I should say, I don't know, a big piece of what we do has always been at the heart of our business, and our DNA is we've been a very mission-minded business. And very early on, we tithe 10% of our corporate profits, my wife and I. And in the past, well, now since 2013, we've been taking those corporate profits and putting into a fund. And when we have enough money, we're going and building houses in Mexico. We partnered with an organization called YWAM. And we went on a trip where somebody paid for us to go. We just had to fly to the Dominican Republic, and they paid for the house. They paid for our food, our lodging, and everything, the accommodations and programming fees while we were there. And then 2 days we built a house and gave it away to a deserving family who never would have been able to buy a house on their own. Wow. And my family and I were wrecked from that experience. And we came back and I told my wife, I said, I want to do this. And this was at the time when we were not financially strong as we're coming out of one of those recessions. And but then it worked, you know, lo and behold, we committed to it. And now we're going on. We did our first trip in 2013. And now we're doing two trips a year. We're building three houses each time. And we're paying for anybody who wants to come on those trips to take a short-term family-friendly mission trip with us down to Mexico. And in 2 days, we build a house and we give it to a deserving family. And now we're seeing the ripple effect of those folks that are going
on
those trips.
So
and
they're beautiful, with man. Their thank you for having that.
Somebody's you don't have to thank me. I get to do that. I get to do that, Saket. It's awesome. It's just amazing. So that's
amazing when the mission ties to a purpose and the financial wealth is driven off purpose. There's just you'll never stop because
you
stop, you're gonna stop building homes.
Right? You're right. That's I mean, I love this business. I love doing what I do. I just love to contribute. It's not a game, but you get it. You know, we get to get up and do things better and keep score. But now when we keep score, 10% of that goes over here. We get to build more houses. Exactly. And you're right. If we stop, I know that there's somebody that wouldn't get a house if we did. So as long as I got air in my lungs, we're going to continue on.
Awesome, Scott. Scott, this is amazing, dude. I know you do a lot of different things. Where can people learn more about your offering, your funds, investing opportunity? Maybe somebody wants to become an actor, get access to it. Courses.
Sure. Everything is all in one place. It's at selfstorageinvesting.com. And you just pick on the tab, whether you're looking to learn more about self-storage. There's lots of resources there. If you want to do it on your own as an active investor, we do have all types of educational materials. And then if you want to invest passively and come alongside of us as well, then click on the passive storage investing tab as well. So we are all things self-storage, and we built an incredible community and an ecosystem. And I'd love to have you come along and check us out and see what we're all about.
Awesome. Well, Scott, thank you again for spending your valuable hours. And for the listeners, Scott's a real deal. If you didn't see this guy's heart show up in the conversation, at least check it out. I think the stuff that he's put together with his team is worth looking into. As storage asset, in full transparency, I am looking at storage as an asset class for myself and my investors as well. So it's worth checking out. Now, not every asset class is for everyone, so you have to figure out what works for you. I'm more than happy to have a conversation. I'm sure Scott and his team would be happy to have a conversation. And
of course.
So thank you for spending your time. And Scott, thank you for being on the show.
All right. My pleasure, Saket. Good to see you. Take care.
Good to see you too, buddy.
If you got value from this episode, you might consider sharing this content with a friend. But most importantly, be sure to take action on what you've learned. One way you can take the next step is to connect directly with Saket on an investor call. That link is waiting for you in the show notes below.